Hello, hello. And so for this Bagel Bite, here's an interview with Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Romaine, where we have a robust discussion on the rather divergent topics of faith schools and assisted dying. This was recorded at Limud Festival 2019. Hope you find it interesting.
So for this Bagel Bite, I'm joined by Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Romaine, who is the progressive rabbi for Maidenhead Synagogue. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine. Slight correction. It's a reform synagogue, but progressive reform is much for muchness. But there we go.
Thank you for correcting. I am, honestly, I am trying so hard with language, because it's very important. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm at the mood at the moment and enjoying myself enormously.
And we're going to be talking about a couple of rather intense topics, I'd say. I know that you are not a fan of faith schools.
Correct.
My wife always tells me I make everything about myself, but it's as a frame of context. I went to a Jewish primary school and a secular secondary school. So I quite enjoyed that because it meant that I had the grounding of Yiddishkeit whilst mixing with everybody else in a secular, and I quite like the balance. Is your approach that there is no such thing as a good faith school, or is it carte blanche? We should never, ever have them and they shouldn't exist.
No, it's not a doctrinaire position. I mean, there are a lot of good faith schools, and the fact that you had a good experience is great. That's wonderful. My problem is the unintended consequence of faith schools, because effectively the net result is segregation. Jews over here, Hindus in that school, Catholics in this school, Protestants over here, Muslims over there, and you're dividing society. And it's daft on two reasons. Firstly, because we are a multi-faith, multi-racial, multi-religious society, and therefore it seems daft to grow up the children as strangers. They've got to emerge into society eventually, so why not get them used to each other, understanding each other right from the word go? That's why, for instance, I sent my children, because I did have the option of a Jewish school nearby, I sent them deliberately to a community school, because I wanted them to sit next to a Christian child in class and to play football with a Hindu and get detention with a Muslim and walk home with an atheist. And it was good for them to get to know my children, for my children to get to them, and they emerged as better citizens. They still got their faith and their Yiddishkeit and their Jewish identity from the home and from the synagogue and from the religion school, but they were part of wider society as well. And the other thing is, of course, if you think about it, we would never be in this position if we were starting from scratch. I mean, it would be unthinkable to segregate any other part of national life that was taxpayer funded. That we wouldn't say, oh, hospitals, those walls are just for Muslims, or swimming pools, that lane is just for Jews, or when you go into the cinema, we want Muslims at the back and Huguenots at the front. Yeah, it would be unthinkable, it would be laughable. We wouldn't do it with race. We wouldn't say blacks in one place, whites in another, browns in another. It would be not only laughable, be racist, to be legal. And yet we do it with religion. And the really, really gut thing is we do it with children who we are trying to bring up, we hope, as an educated, as tolerance and mutual understanding. And what do? We segregate them at the school gate. It creates an us and them, Jews one way, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, all the other way. It's daft educationally. And the only reason we tolerate it is because that's the system we've inherited. If we were to invent society, we wouldn't dream of doing such a thing.
I would say, though, as a rebuttal of that. So you said that your kids had that Jewish upbringing in the home, but you're a rabbi. So I would expect that you know a lot about Yiddishkeit in a way that other people wouldn't. And so in my scenario, to be fair, my parents did know, you know, enough Yiddishkeit to do the practical stuff. But there was things that I learnt at Jewish school that I wouldn't have learned otherwise. My fluency in Hebrew wouldn't be the same if I hadn't gone to a Jewish school.
So what you're saying is that a lot of Jewish homes have a sort of weak educational background and therefore Jewish day schools make up for it. I get that point, except the solution is the wrong solution. The answer is to put an enormous investment into Jewish home education, Jewish adult education, because then you get a double whammy. You get the adults being more knowledgeable and committed, and you get the children having that passed on, and you still have the children getting their Jewishness from home and their civil ability from everyday life. I mean, the reality is most Jews, not the highly assimilated, assimilated and not the ultra-Orthodox have a foot in both worlds. And we live in both worlds, and therefore we need the children to feel at home in both camps. You know something? It's not just the impact on Jewish children. It's the impact on the non-Jewish children. I founded an organization called the Accord Coalition, which works to try and make faith schools more inclusive. Not just Jewish schools, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, whatever. We give an award every year. There was this particular school which won the award for inclusivity. And I went to it, and the head there very proudly said they had every faith in the world. Literally. Even if it was only one representative, virtually. And do you know where it was? It was in Finchley. And the only faith they did not have was Jews. Here was a school in Finchley. In other words, because they all went to Jewish day schools. And therefore the children, those 400 or 500 children at that school, they saw Jews on the other side of the street or in the shops. They never actually talked to Jews. And so it's not just a matter of denying Jewish children to being part of the world. Well, it's denuding other parts of society the ability to get to know a Jew. And actually, they've got two eyes and two ears, one nose and ordinary, and just the same. So actually, it's a massive own goal, and it's a disservice not just to children, but to social cohesion.
I am playing devil's advocate here slightly, because actually, I get your points. I've had trouble with faith schools myself. I'm not quite as articulate about the reasons why as you are. Maybe I haven't thought about it quite as much. But I was in, as a teenager, I was a madrecha leader for Bnei Akiva. And that was an interesting experience. And there was the Rosh, the head of the Leeds bit, who first year at university and was horrified that he had to interact with non-Jews. And I found that shocking. I found that absolutely shocking. So I do get your point.
And also you have to ask yourself, why has there been this proliferation of Jewish day schools? Because when your parents went to school, it was a minority, maybe one in 50 children, Jewish children, who went to a Jewish day school. Now it's virtually one in 50 that doesn't. And the reason is that Jewish philanthropists were persuaded to put money into schools to stop intermarriage. But it's a fallacy, because even when you, if you go to primary school, secondary school, you still come out at some point, at university or at the office or whatever, and you meet the rest of the world. And I used to run seminars at the Sternberg Centre in Finchley called I'm Jewish, My Partner Isn't. And although it was a reform centre, we had at least 50% of people coming from, not just from Orthodox synagogues, but from Jewish day schools, from Hasmonean and JFS in London. Because yes, the children got their Jewish education, but they still met somebody non-Jewish at the bus stop, at the gym, at the office party, because of the C word. Chance. And all of them, by the way, said to me, look, we would have been just as happy marrying somebody Jewish. It just so happened that I met this person and fell in love.
I do think as well, just for non-Jewish listeners, but I know there are some non-Jewish listeners, all this type of thing's quite difficult. And I know that, say, growing up with my non-Jewish friends, the whole idea of intermarriage is a very, very difficult concept. It's a struggle, I think, for most, for someone like me who is, I'm typical, right? Someone who is not particularly uber from, so religious, but wants to have a Jewish life. Intermarriage is a big problem for that, for various reasons, for the frame of reference, that if you're not Jewish, it's difficult to understand the Jewish mentality. I would, you might disagree, and I'm feel free to. But is it not quite sad that education is wrapped up in that?
Well, yes, and it's sad, but more importantly, it doesn't work. So it's not as if pumping all these millions has stopped Jews marrying non-Jews. It hasn't. And the intermarriage rate is just as high. You may have a better educated Jew marrying somebody non-Jewish, or they may have a strong sense of Jewish identity, and that's great. But the primary purpose was to stop intermarriage. By the way, I never use the word marrying out. Actually, very often it's the complete reverse. It's the non-Jewish person marrying in, because there are a lot of nothings out there, a lot of people who've got no background. They really are genuinely not churchgoers, and they meet Jews who, maybe like a lot of Jews, aren't particularly religious, but have got a sense of Jewish culture, Jewish values, Jewish home life, and these non-Jewish people are attracted to it. And therefore, I'm not saying they will necessarily convert, but they will certainly be Judeo-friendly and also be quite happy if the Jewish partner, male or female, wants to lead a Jewish home life or bring up the children as Jewish. Because again, something's enormous has changed within the Jewish world, and there's a lot of Jews, whereas 40, 50 years ago, if you marry somebody non-Jewish, you're sticking up two fingers against Moses and you're abandoning Judaism. A lot of Jews will now see no discrepancy between loving their Judaism, but also loving their non-Jewish partner, and therefore it's a both and. And it's really a matter of whether that's right or wrong doesn't really matter. That's the situation. That's the social reality. So the real question is, what do the rabbis, what do the synagogues do about it? Do we slam the phone down, shut the door in their face, or do we say, okay, I can't legislate for who you fall in love with, but you're still Jewish, your partner is a human being, and they are welcome, and if they're not welcome, you won't be welcome. So it's an open house, and you're still welcome to come along, and you're welcome to pass it on to your children.
Right, but then I know that, say, the progressive movements have an easier job with that than orthodoxy, which is, I know, you know, orthodoxy can't represent orthodoxy, right? But has a more difficult time with that because things like, can someone get called up for an aliyah if they've married
someone? They only have a harder time with it because they make themselves have a harder time with it. No, seriously, you know, there's no reason. And there are some Orthodox rabbis who are very open and very welcoming and who say, look, you know, actually, I'd think it's better to marry within the faith, just like a Catholic should marry a Catholic and a Sikh a Sikh, particularly with religions that are very home-based, so there's no confusion and there's no argy-bargy or running sores or sudden hiccups. But you've made your choice, but you're still Jewish. It's only because we're so used to people slamming the door shut that we think it's okay for people to do that. Actually, it's not. It's very rude. It's very hurtful. And what does it achieve? Absolutely nothing. At these seminars which I ran, I must have counselled about 3,000 or 4,000 couples, literally. Never, ever did they say, Rabbi, shall we get married? They said, Rabbi, we are getting married. Can you help? People are doing it. I'm not giving people the green light. They've taken it long ago. And by the way, the big rise in mixed faith marriages wasn't like in the 80s, it was in the 50s. That's when it all started. That's when the statistics started shooting up. So we're not just talking about today's couples, but we're talking about the children of people who were mixed faith marriages. In other words, a lot of grandparents were mixed faith. So if the Jewish community is being obstructionist, it's because it's choosing to be obstructionist. It doesn't have to be.
One of the many reasons I started this podcast is because I've noticed a tendency on the religious right to confuse religiousness and decency. Decency is, for some reason, seems to be very underestimated as an important part of Judaism. Just brings to mind a story of, I know a couple where one wasn't Jewish, and the other one was, and he wanted to convert through the Orthodox Bet Din. I went to the Bet Din for a meeting, and the Dayan, and I won't say which Bet Din it was, and Bet Din, the religious court, with the door open, so this guy could hear, they went, there's one of the guys outside wanting to join, ugh, we have to deal with this nonsense. Saying it loudly so that he would hear and be embarrassed. That's not a decent thing to do.
It's not manners, it's not civility. And by the way, it's a massive own goal. Because actually, if you think about it, number one, if somebody wants to convert, that's an amazing compliment. You know, somebody wants to join your club. Oh, isn't that nice? They agree with us. Whereas we've been sort of indoctrinated almost by sort of centuries of the Jewish-Christian divide to think us and them and to think, oh my God, what if someone wants to convert? What are they going to do? Are they going to infiltrate? Are they going to poison us? You know, why this negative attitude? We should be pleased that somebody says, your God should be my God and your people should be my God. If you go up to a priest or imam and say you want to convert, they say, welcome, come in. Why are we so negative?
Yeah, but isn't that because we're just suspicious because of history?
Yeah, exactly. History. There aren't any Cossacks around. They're not burning us at the stake. The Spanish Inquisition has gone. So forget history. Talk about today. And by the way, it's also an own goal, because not only is it rude and wrong, but also the reality is that the Jewish partner is going to marry this non-Jew, come what may. It's only a question of whether it's in synagogue with the rabbi's blessing or without in the registry office. And if it's without and they feel pushed away, then you're losing the Jewish person, and you're almost certainly losing the next generation. If that person converts, you actually not only keep the Jew Jewish, you actually double your numbers.
I think it's a problem with this kind of ideological fervour.
No, it's ghetto mentality. It's us and them, and by the way, them is really nasty, and they're out to get us, and they're going to sort of burn us at the stake or re-crucify us or whatever. Most people who convert are just lovely people, and they convert not for an ulterior motive, it's because they want to be Jewish. People say, oh, it's a particularly, if they're converting to marry somebody, it's not valid. Well, actually, there's many different reasons of converting, because you find a book and read it, or because you have an experience. But actually, converting because you marry somebody is the best possible reason, because that way, you get to know Jewish life from the inside, not theoretically from a book. You've got a Jewish support group. You know what a Jewish mother-in-law is. Oh, and you get the reality of Jewish life. And also you then have a support group afterwards. And you're therefore sort of supported and ingrained within communal life. Why this negativity? We should be so pleased that people want to join our club.
Can I just get back to the relationship with education, just because I understand about that intermarriage is one of the key principles as to why faith schools exist, but there must be more to it than that.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's Jewish education, but with the subtext, if you get them to be strong Jews, therefore they will not marry somebody non-Jewish. That was the impetus, or the sort of the subplot, for this enormous leap in the sort of in the 70s and 80s into Jewish day schools. But it's not just Jewish day schools. I worry about Catholic schools, Hindu schools, Sikh schools.
Right, the issue with all of these schools is that academically they're all pretty great. Not all of them, for sure, but on average, faith schools tend to do better in league tables than non-faith schools, if you average it out. So then doesn't that become a self-fulfilling prophecy? So then people go, oh, well, we don't really care about the faith bit, but they're better for whatever reason, and they do better, and then parents send the kids there because they're better, and it creates this self-perpetuating issue of people who keep on sending the kids to faith schools and go, well, they might have a little bit of indoctrination, but who cares? They're getting a good education at the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, I'm not going to deny for one moment that some faith schools are really, really good academically. But again, look at the bigger picture. They're creating ghettos. We spent a couple hundred years getting out of the ghettos. And why recreate them?
That's not really true. So you take...
Of course it's true. People move into areas precisely because they want to get into a faith school. I mean, just think of the Hindus. Forget about us. Until recently, the Hindus were very assimilated into wider culture. And suddenly they started having faith schools and one's opened up. So what's happened? A lot of Hindus have moved into that area and now a second's opened up. They cause social engineering. It's not the intention, but it's the effect.
It might be the intention.
Even worse.
Can we just move on? Because I know the other topic that's quite close to your heart is assisted dying, right? And so I know we're doing a bit of a dramatic switch here, which again is a rather controversial topic. So do you want to just outline where you come at it?
Yes, assisted dying is when somebody who is terminally ill, in other words, defined as they've got 6 months or less to live, so they're dying anyway, and they're either in pain or in dignity, and they want to let go now rather than stagger on to the final end, which usually means either a forest of tubes coming out of them or being a narcotic stupor or in agony or asphyxiating or choking to death. And they say, well, look, you know, I've led a life. It's coming to an end. I've tried to live well. I'd like to die well. Now, at the moment, they're denied that and they have to sort of either carry on in pain, or they have to maybe attempt suicide, which is a horrible thing to do and it's awful for the relatives as well, and is often botched. Or they have to go abroad because it is allowed in certain countries abroad, particularly Dignitas, which is why you hear about it and people going to Switzerland have an assisted death there. Assisted death meaning that you, not somebody else, you yourself take a potion which then ends your life within a minute or two. And at the moment it's illegal, but I think, and I'm vice president actually of Dignity in Dying, which is campaigning to change the law. In terms of what people want, all the opinion polls, they're always 81, 82, 83% of people would like to have the option, not necessarily to do it, because most of us, to be honest, will probably carry on to our last breath, but we certainly want to have that option. That if we're facing something awful like a really nasty cancer or Huntington's disease or motor neuron disease, and we know what horrible ends they are, then they want to have that option of dying a little bit earlier and rather than staggering on. So we're trying to press the government to pass the law to make it legal with lots of safeguards. I have to say that until about 10 years ago, I followed the traditional line of saying thou shalt not, because God gives and God takes and that's it, and it's all in God's hands. And then I've seen, as a rabbi, I've just been to too many hospitals or hospices, which do great work, where people still die in pain. And you think, why? What's the point? What's the advantage? If somebody wants to let go, and we're not talking about somebody, you know, in their 40s having a midlife crisis, we're talking about somebody who is dying. No doubt about it. They're already dying. And it's just a matter of whether it's sort of 6 weeks or in 2 days. What benefit do we achieve for forcing them to stay alive against their will in pain? So I'd like the law changed so that if you meet certain conditions, like you're terminally ill, you've got two independent witnesses and you've been to a doctor and there's judicial oversight and it's definitely your free will, then you can do so.
Apart from the free will point, that is obviously a very valid point, why shouldn't anyone just have suicide machines? You know, you walk in and don't walk out again. Why do you need to be sick to do that?
Well, because, I mean, suicide machines for when? For people who are terminally ill?
Not necessarily. I'm saying that if it's about someone wanting to end their life, why then deny anyone else the option? So someone else doesn't want to live anymore, but they're perfectly healthy. I hate using the slippery slope argument, but that is one of the arguments, right? One, how would you ensure that wouldn't happen? I know there's about the checks and balances, fine. But then why should someone be prevented?
I understand that argument. I suppose the starting point is that life is precious, and that's why those people in favour of dignity dying are not just secularists and humanists, but they're from all different religious groups as well. And we've got a bishop and an imam and rabbis in favour. In fact, some very high church clergy, such as Archbishop Tutu, you know, one of the major world Christian figures, or the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, also came out in favour. We see life as precious, which is why we don't want people to dismiss life or give up life because of a whim, or they're depressed, or their partner's left them, or because they've gone bankrupt, or 101 reasons, which you could say are spurious or temporary, and that given a few months or weeks, people would get over. These are people who are dying anyway. So it's a very clear red line to try and stop that slippery slope. And so they have to be certified, not by one, but by two doctors, as dying anyway. So we're not taking away a life, we're just shortening a life that's already about to go out.
I kind of want to push you a little bit on that point. Wouldn't one lead to the other, though, in reality?
No, because doctors will certify you as having 6 months to live, or roughly, but there are things you can do about it. But we're talking about somebody who is dying, because otherwise it would be, you're quite right, unless you had this red line, and it's very hard to think of another red line that would be quite as strong. Otherwise, it's a free-for-all, there is a slippery slope, and you get situations which I don't approve of, where you have, in some countries, a very, very open policy, where in the Netherlands, you actually do have euthanasia, or assisted dying, on pretty spurious grounds, and for people who are going through a bad patch. And you think, well, gosh, if they met somebody else or had some right treatment, they could be living a very happy and fulfilling life.
And it's also open to abuse and stuff like that. So how does that interact with your Judaism?
Well, if you think about it, it acts very well in that Judaism is about helping people. We've always had this line of God gives and God takes, but actually it's not true. We don't say, oh, look, there's a man having a heart attack. What a shame. We rush him off to hospital, or we give him a defibrillator. We try and stop God from killing him. We don't say, oh, that person sort of had a road accident and is losing pints of blood. We immediately infuse him with new blood. We play God. We even give heart transplants. Yes. And we're constantly playing God to help people. And if it helps somebody to avoid pain and agony, shouldn't that be in the same spectrum?
That's a very different line to your Orthodox colleagues, right?
No, also some Reformed colleagues. So, you know, there's a genuine debate. I'm not saying my view's right. I happen to think it is. But I think it is. There are arguments against. And I was also took the argument against until I came up with the reality as a rabbi of seeing so many people dying in pain. Plus, also, I was worried about the slippery slope. But now the law that's being proposed has got so many sort of checks and balances about medical oversight, about judicial oversight, that you can be pretty sure that it'll only be for someone who really, really wants it. Which is why, for instance, they have to be not only dying, but also mentally competent. So it wouldn't apply to someone who had Alzheimer's or was in a coma, because you don't know what they really, really think. And by the way, the other thing is, in this instance, and I would never say this on any other issue, it's one of those rare cases when we can see the future, which may sound a bit, oh, that's outrageous. But actually, this law that I'm backing and proposing has been in evidence in the state of Oregon in the United States for the last 25 years, literally 25 years. So we know what happens, and we can track the statistics. And it's fascinating, because a lot of people apply for an assisted death but don't take it out. In other words, they do the paperwork, but actually they want to carry on because the life force is so strong. And it's only a very small percentage that actually go for it because they're in such a pain or in dignity.
You articulate it well, right? You've thought about it.
I'm sorry for being right.
I think
give me your question.
I'm almost speechless.
You're blushing, actually. It's as if you're too embarrassed to say the question.
No, I'm just hot.
No,
I'm not blushing. I'm just not sure how to follow it up. Because again, it's a gym. You know, you don't want to see someone in pain. I don't want to ask the really stupid questions. You know, like the, they might find a cure tomorrow. And it's just like, well, it's not the way science works, right? If you have like an incredibly rare form of cancer and you're given a month to live or 2 months to live, they're not going to cure it in 2 months, are they?
Probably not. But also there comes a point where people make a choice.
Right.
You know. Or if they are going to cure it, they will probably cure it at an earlier stage before the cancer has taken hold. Because we're talking about end of life here. We're not talking about when the cancer is first diagnosed and whether you treat it with radiotherapy or chemotherapy or this new wonder drug. This is after the cancer's taken hold, is ineradicable, and you're at the end of life.
Does it have any impact religiously? So in terms of being buried?
No. No. I mean, there used to be this attitude that someone who committed suicide, which is a big sin, by the way, in Jewish law, used to be buried outside of the Jewish cemetery. And of course, the rabbis, and to their credit, this was Orthodox rabbis as well as Reform, said, well, actually, who do we punish? Not the dead person, they're dead. All we're doing is punishing the relatives who not only have the disgrace of a suicide and the grief, but they also have this, as often happens, this terrible guilt. You know, oh, why didn't we see the warning signs? Or if only we could have done something, or why didn't we help? So they decided, and there was a really neat Jewish formula here. They decided, yes, it's a sin to commit suicide, but at the moment when you jump off the bridge or pull the trigger, no right person in their right mind does that. Therefore, at that particular moment, you're insane. Therefore, you're not responsible for your action. Therefore, you can't be blamed. And therefore, you can be buried in a cemetery.
That is such a Talmudic way of doing it.
Well, it's Jewish, and I'm a rabbi. And that applies even to someone who commits suicide. How much more so to someone who is already dying and has chosen to go to Dignitas. So those sort of people, they would have a normal burial. With Dignitas, it's slightly different because of the law of the land, and they actually have to be buried over or cremated over there. And then their ashes brought back. But if it was to happen here, then it would be the normal burial or cremation, if for those who so wish, and the normal kaddish and the normal shiva and all the normal things.
I asked you before we started this, you know, the couple of topics, and assisted dying is one that just isn't on my radar, right? It's not that I don't care, it's just not on my radar. Why is it so important to you?
Yom Kippur. In Yom Kippur, I told the rest of the community, my synagogue in Maidenhead in Berkshire, you know, what to do and how we should change and how we should make this year different from the next last year and new resolutions. And I thought, hang on, I'm telling everybody else this. What am I doing myself? And I had just seen, as I mentioned earlier, yet another patient literally doubled up in pain. And when I say doubled up, it's not an expression. He was literally doubled up on his bed in pain. In fact, he was facing head down onto the bed, his knees drawn up into his stomach, just in agony. And of course, the doctors were trying to help him with drugs and whatever, but it didn't work. And I thought, what is the point? Why can't he get a prescription from the doctor, which his wife takes to the chemist, gives him the potion? And by the way, this is where assisted dying is different from euthanasia, which is a bit of a dirty word for a lot of people. Euthanasia is when somebody else kills you, an individual, the doctor, the state, whoever, and for whatever reason. Assisted dying is when you do it yourself. And the only assisted bit is because you got a prescription from the doctor to a potion, which you yourself take, and it has to be you. And the law of the land would be here, and it certainly is abroad, that even if you're disabled, you have to somehow take the potion with the one finger that still works, or by pressing a button that lifts the artificial cup into your mouth. So it's essentially your choice, and that you and nobody else has initiated the process, once again, to ensure that it is a free will thing and not somebody else assuming it on your behalf.
Right. I mean, there still could be pressure there, in reality. They could still feel like they're a burden to the family or whatever, right?
They could be, but A, they're dying already, or they would be. B, they'd have to be signed off by two independent doctors. They have to make a written declaration. They have to be interviewed privately, by the way, with nobody else there. There has to be a judicial oversight just to check that everything's been done. And the reality, again, Oregon, this place that's been doing it for the last 25 years, is really interesting because the people that do opt for assisted dying are not like little old ladies being bullied by their vicious grandchildren who are after their family loot. It's actually for people who are usually sort of AB class, economic class, are successful, used to living their own life, they've chosen their own job, their own partner, their own lifestyle, and they want to choose their death as well. It's also to do with personal autonomy. Please God, not by you or me or anybody listening.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, we all want to go in a nice way. But that's the whole point. We don't. And there are some pretty ghastly deaths out there. And I think if you've got a right to live as well as possible, I think you should have a right to die as well as possible. You only do it once. Might as well get it right.
I have nothing more to add. Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Remain, thank you very much. And that's that. Until next time, bagelers.